the seismic Supreme Court ruling on presidential immunity that could shape America for years to come.
There is a principle that nobody is above the law, and it has always been understood that the president himself has to abide by the law. This opinion, not only does it grant this immunity, but it grants the immunity in some really sweeping ways, I think go far beyond anything anybody could have assumed.
Plus, thousands of Palestinians displaced multiple times already are ordered to relocate once again.
The latest order is a sign that Hamas has managed to regroup, and we could soon see Israeli forces moving back into Khan Yunis and a resumption of heavy fighting.
And the European leader with the closest ties to Russia meets with Ukraine's president in a rare visit to Kyiv. Today is July 2nd, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Lori London. Israeli forces bombarded several areas of southern Gaza Tuesday, and thousands of Palestinians fled their homes in what could be part of a final push of Israel's intensive military operations in 9 months of war. Associated Press correspondent Yosef Fetterman reports.
The Israeli military has ordered a mass evacuation from a large part of the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis. This isn't the first time we've seen an evacuation order like this. Israel spent several months inside Khan Yunis battling Hamas before withdrawing earlier this year. The latest order is a sign that Hamas has managed to regroup, and we could soon see Israeli forces moving back into Khan Yunis and a resumption of heavy fighting.
AP correspondent Yosef Fetterman. Gaza's European hospital in Khan Yunis is virtually empty, with staff and patients fleeing after the Israeli army's orders for residents in the surrounding areas to evacuate. UNRWA spokesperson Louise Waterridge.
UNRWA estimates that around 250,000 people have been impacted by these orders. Of course, as usual, we expect these numbers to grow. But, you know, for us, this is it's another devastating blow to the humanitarian response here. It's another devastating blow for the people and the families on the ground. It seems that they are forcibly being displaced again and again. You know, making these decisions is now impossible.
Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken affirmed Monday that President Joe Biden's proposal to end the Israel-Hamas conflict is achievable and urged Hamas to accept it. Blinken also underlined the importance of post-war plans to rebuild Gaza and prevent a security vacuum in the territory. VOA's Veronica Balteras Iglesias reports.
As Israeli troops continue deepening their incursions in Gaza in search of militants, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced Monday that Hamas's military capabilities have almost been eliminated.
We are advancing to the end of the phase of eliminating the terrorist army of Hamas, and there will be a continuation to strike its remnants.
The announcement was made as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, in an interview at the Brookings Institution in Washington, called on Hamas's leadership to accept a phased peace proposal currently on the table.
I think the proposal that President Biden put forward is achievable. And it would be the best way forward, the quickest way to end the conflict in Gaza, to stop the violence, to massively surge assistance, to get everyone home, including American hostages.
As the secretary spoke, the voices of protesters gathered outside the Brookings Institution could also be heard. Blinken, who didn't acknowledge them, stressed that the Israel-Hamas conflict cannot end with a vacuum in Gaza.
It has to end in a way that makes sure that there are clear, coherent, achievable plans for Gaza's governance, for its security, and of course, to start to help people to rebuild their lives that have been so decimated and destroyed.
One of the Palestinians whose life has radically changed and wants accountability is Dr. Mohammed Abu Selmeya. The director of Al-Shifa Hospital was released early Monday after being in Israeli custody since November. He says prisoners were subjected to severe torture and his little finger was broken. He was repeatedly hit on the head until he bled. He says there was almost daily torture in Israeli prisons.
We were subjected to severe torture. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We've seen families fleeing the fighting, and they're facing unimaginable challenges. Every step of their journey is fraught with danger. Roads are blocked, ports are closed.
That was World Food Programme spokesperson in DRC, Shelley Takral, on the challenges facing civilians trying to escape the violence in Goma. Details coming up also. The International Criminal Court's prosecutor says he will seek arrest warrants for alleged atrocities in West Darfur. And Egyptians are marking the anniversary of the 2011 uprising amid an economic crisis and security crackdown. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Witnesses are reporting bodies in the streets as hundreds of thousands of people flee in terror from heavy fighting in Goma, the largest city in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, that now appears to be mostly under control of M23 rebels. Some of the chaos has spread to the capital, Kinshasa, which attacks are reported on the U.S., French, and other embassies, and there are concerns the violence could spread to neighboring countries. In an extraordinary ministerial meeting today to discuss the rapidly escalating conflict, the African Union condemned the violence, which included rapes, and urged the rebels to lay down their arms. Cornel Nanga, leader of the AFC Rebel Alliance that includes M23, told Reuters that the airport was in their hands. Roads and ports were cut off. M23 briefly occupied Goma once before in 2012. Then, and it was defeated and lay dormant for almost a decade. This time around, M23 appears to be in a stronger position to keep hold of Goma. Just a while back, I talked to our VOA reporter in Goma, Sabiti Jafar Al-Katanti, for updates. He says fighting's still going on in some Goma neighborhoods. In the parts where M23 rebels have control, he says they are telling residents that they are not bad people and are simply there to liberate them. For now, he says, the area in Goma where he is at is calm.
I'm outside with other colleagues, journalists, and we are also meeting some people, walking a bit, talking themselves, but the city is still quiet because there is no activity. Maybe starting by tomorrow, life will start organizing slowly.
And videos circulating in local WhatsApp groups was showing rebels marching through the city and of a few citizens lining the streets welcoming them.
Yes, that happened in many places. M23 was in Hindi, was in Keshero, in many neighborhoods where they were welcomed with people. And the information on my possession, I know that they did a small meeting in Keshero at a place called Karibu Hotel, where they talked to locals saying, don't worry, we are not bad people. We came to liberate you. We will work together with you and any other soldiers who will decide to join us to change the power. And people were applauding them, they clapped, and then the M23 left going to another neighborhood. But because I put on me my PPE, such as my helmet and flat jacket, and I have a camera with me, and then I met a group of some M23 officers. They checked my cards, who I am, and then they told me it's not a good idea to start working today in this time because they're still cleaning the city, and they say start work tomorrow. So they want us to go back to our hotel and to not go far in the city center as they're still cleaning the city.
And as you know, Jafar, on last Friday, the military governor of North Kivu, the province of which Goma is the capital, was fatally wounded on the battlefield. Is there any remnants of any government officials in and around Goma right now?
The information I have is that the day the city of Goma fell into M23, in the night, all authorities left Goma by a boat going to Bukavu. For now, M23 is the only one boat rolling the city of Goma, except some neighborhoods where some resistance still ongoing, fighting still ongoing in some neighborhoods such as Majengo, Katoi in Goma, then Buhene, Nyiragongo territory. But we can say that the majority, almost all the city of Goma, is under M23 control.
How about the United Nations peacekeeping mission in Goma? Are they still there or have they evacuated as well?
No, the peacekeepers are in Goma. I was talking about peacekeepers doesn't have problems. They are in Goma and they're still moving.
That was VOA reporter Sabiti Jafar Al-Khatanti. He spoke to me from Goma. United Nations agencies warn fierce fighting between M23 rebels and Democratic Republic of Congo troops in and around the eastern city of Goma, creating a protection crisis of huge proportions. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
United Nations officials describe scenes of utter chaos amid escalating violence in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, with hundreds of thousands of people fleeing multiple active conflict zones. The spokesperson for the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Laerke, says colleagues in Goma report heavy small arms and mortar fire across the city, with many bodies in the streets.
We have reports of rapes committed by fighters, looting of property, including of a humanitarian warehouse, and humanitarian and health facilities being hit. Hospitals in Goma are reportedly overwhelmed, struggling to manage the influx of wounded people.
Since the flare-up of fighting in recent weeks, Laerke says hundreds of thousands of people have fled the violence, including 700,000 displaced people living in dire conditions on the outskirts of Goma. He adds non-essential UN staff have been relocated to reduce risks, but critical personnel remain in Goma. The World Food Programme spokesperson in the DRC, Shelley Takral, says WFP is retaining only critical staff in this volatile area. Speaking from the capital, Kinshasa, she told journalists in Geneva that protection concerns are growing. She says gender-based violence is rampant and people have limited access to food and clean drinking water.
We've seen families fleeing the fighting, and they're facing unimaginable challenges. Every step of their journey is fraught with danger. Roads are blocked, ports are closed, and those crossing Lake Kivu risk their lives in makeshift boats.
Dr. Adelheid Marsching is the World Health Organization's emergency coordinator for the DRC. She says hundreds of people have been admitted into hospitals, most with gunshot wounds, with many at risk of secondary infections.
WHO is especially worried for the health and safety of women and girls who are at the higher risk of violence, including rape. Pregnant women are at risk with very high maternal death rates, even before this recent escalation of violence.
She warns conditions in this battle-scarred region are rife for the spread of infectious diseases such as cholera and measles. She says both the physical and mental toll of this war is likely to be enormous. As the risks grow, she notes, it will become much harder for people to get the health care they need. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa is calling for an immediate ceasefire and the resumption of peace talks in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, marking a shift in his country's position on the conflict. The call for dialogue follows the deaths of 14 South African peacekeepers in combat with M23 rebels near Goma in the past few days. Reports indicate the rebels have captured many other troops. Darren Taylor reports.
The South African government said Tuesday that President Cyril Ramaphosa spoke by phone with Rwandan President Paul Kagame to discuss the conflict in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. M23 rebels, who the DRC says are supported by Rwanda, say they now control Goma, where a UN-backed peacekeeping force consisting largely of South African soldiers is also present. The statement from Pretoria said Ramaphosa and Kagame agreed on the urgent need for a ceasefire and peace talks involving all parties to the conflict as soon as possible. This is a departure from South Africa's longtime support for DRC forces in their fight against the rebels. But a veteran of South Africa's previous attempts to broker peace in the DRC, General Maumela Motau, says Kagame has previously agreed to talks and ceasefires that never happened or failed. He was part of former South African President Nelson Mandela's attempts to foster peace in the Great Lakes region in the late 1990s and early 2000s.
The problem comes from Rwanda. Rwanda arms these groups. We tried to solve this problem. You know, President Mandela spoke to President Kagame and he didn't mix his word. He told him, if you get involved in the Congo, we will actually be forced to deal with you. And President Mandela sent a high-powered delegation, which was made of the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Alfred Nzo, Minister of Defense, Joe Modise, and accompanied by myself, to go and deliver those messages, now written messages, to President Museveni of Uganda and Kagame of Rwanda.
Rwanda has denied directly backing the M23, one of dozens of rebel groups operating in eastern DRC, despite reports from the United Nations and other organizations linking it to the group. However, Kigali has said it will defend its territory from attacks by rebels in the DRC. Rwanda accuses the DRC of backing the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda, a Hutu ethnic force that has attacked ethnic Tutsis in both countries. Kagame and DRC President Felix Tshisekedi are tentatively to meet Wednesday in Kenya. The head of the Institute for Security Studies in Pretoria, Dr. Yaki Salier, says Ramaphosa has little choice but to pursue dialogue as the South African National Defense Force, the SANDF, is outgunned by the rebels.
The SANDF forces don't have logistic, air and other support. Many of their vehicles and equipment are no longer serviceable, and they have an expansive offensive mandate. In other words, the Forces Intervention Brigade is empowered by the UN to drive M23 out of the area. They attacked and M23 counterattacked, and the South Africans, very much because they don't have the necessary support, equipment, ammunition, eventually were driven away, and M23 has taken Goma.
Opposition parties and civil society groups have asked Ramaphosa to address the nation to disclose his plans to ensure the safety of the soldiers. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The UN says hundreds of people have been wounded and bodies are lying in the streets of Goma after the M23 rebel group advanced in the eastern DRC city. Paula Nanatulia, research associate with the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, says to understand the social and political origins of M23, one has to go back to the First and Second Congo Wars and even the Ugandan Civil War, which ended in 1986.
That rebel group is tied into these regional dynamics that go back to that crisis. About a third of the rebels that prosecuted the war in Uganda, Museveni's rebels, were of Rwandese or Rwandan ethnicity. And then there were migrants that had fled Uganda in 1959. So about a third of the manpower of that rebellion came from this group. After Museveni seized power, they rose to very senior positions in the Ugandan military establishment, security establishment, as well as the Uganda government and the intelligence. Then when this group invaded, when the Rwanda Patriotic Front invaded their country in 1991, that manpower came from this group that I have just described. And a lot of those people, essentially the Uganda military lost about a third of its force, but also back to this rebellion. A lot of the people who led the organizations that eventually morphed into M23, some of them were actually part of this. That citizenship has always been, at difficult moments in history in these two countries, that citizenship always comes up for debate, and sometimes it is manipulated for political purposes, which then creates a sense of marginalization and a sense of insecurity. Right.
So you're saying this goes back more than a generation.
And the only way to solve it is through political, constitutional, legal and legislative measures that has been employed in the DRC as a result of the Sun City Accords, which I participated in. I was working in an organization that was providing technical support to the former Botswana president, Katumila Masire. And one of the elements of the Sun City Accords is precisely this nationality question and how to address and how to pacify the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo by finding a permanent solution to the problem of the citizenship of the Congolese of Rwandan ethnicity. And by the way, they're not just Tutsis. These are Tutsis, Hutus, and Twa. So when we talk about the Banyamulenge, which is the Banyamulenge, these are Congolese of Rwandan ethnicity. No, they're not just Tutsi. They are Tutsi, Hutu, and Twa. So essentially, the M23 has actually grown in scope.
When you were talking about those accords, what happened with those accords when they were trying to reach a peace agreement before, years ago?
Well, the accords were actually successful. In my opinion, as somebody who was involved with them from day one up to the signing. And they were successful in the sense that they gave Congo a chance, right? The 2006 election, which was the first election that Congo had since independence, were held under the aegis of these accords. And then you had a parliament that was set up. You had a government of national unity. You had a security sector reform that included all elements of the Congolese population and so on. And then you also had the Lusaka peace process. The Lusaka peace process was designed to address the external element of the crisis. So you had Rwanda, Uganda, and Burundi that were supporting the rebellion. And then you had Southern African countries like Angola, there was Namibia, there was Zimbabwe, right, that were supporting the Congolese government.
What is the answer for trying to, you know, address their grievances?
The problem is not the framework. The problem is the political will. So right now we have a situation where the relationship between the Rwandan president and the Congolese president is at an all-time low, to such an extent that they're actually even trading insults. And this is something that we've not seen before. The militias that are supporting the Democratic Republic of Congo government seem to have made the calculation that international pressure just does not apply, and they're not going to bend to international pressure. So,
well, does that worry you? I mean, does that mean that we're possibly looking at a regional conflict, a wider regional conflict?
We are potentially looking at a wider regional conflict, because already yesterday we saw some artillery shelling from the DRC side, you know, on Rwandan territory.
That is Paul Nanatulia, research associate with the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA's Carol Van Damme. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The prosecutor of the International Criminal Court says his office will be seeking arrest warrants for alleged atrocities in Sudan's West Darfur. The region has been reported ethnic cleansing by paramilitary forces that have been fighting government forces for 19 months. The Associated Press reports that Karim Kahan told the UN Security Council yesterday that crimes are being committed in Darfur as we speak and daily, and are being used as a weapon of war. Sudan plunged into conflict in mid-April 2023 amid long simmering tensions between its military and paramilitary leaders. Egyptians marked the 14th anniversary of the 25 January revolution of 2011 amid nostalgic longing for its unfulfilled promises and ongoing questions about how to rekindle the popular momentum for democracy and social justice short of another uprising. This year, the anniversary was muted by an economic crisis and security crackdown. Said Sadiq, professor of political sociology at the Egypt-Japan University, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi why these demands have not been met.
There are several factors. One is political instability that followed the ousting of President Mubarak. Egypt experienced significant turmoil, and the transitional government struggled to establish stability and legitimacy, leading to a power vacuum that various factions sought to fulfill. Secondly, military influence. The Egyptian army is a very strong political entity, and it played a crucial role in both the revolution and the subsequent planning of the political landscape. Thirdly, there was fragmentation of the Egyptian opposition that led to the ousting of President Mubarak. And this coalition began to quarrel with each other. They had different ideas about the new political system, secular activists, Islamists, and various other groups with differing agenda that clashed in the end. Fourthly, you had economic challenges. Egypt began to face big challenges after the overthrow of President Mubarak. Economic reform were slow and sometimes were not on the right direction. And so the government began to turn to repression. They could not meet the demands of the people. And so the only option for them is to repress anybody who is making demands. There was also international dynamics and regional dynamics. They didn't want to have trouble in Egypt because it will affect the neighboring countries negatively, especially we are surrounded by a sea of autocratic regimes in the Gulf. There was also public disillusionment. Over time, many Egyptians began to feel that the revolution is not really going into the right direction. And so many segments of the population began to support the idea of returning to the old order, the strongman rule as a means of restoring order. They don't want to have the Islamists who came to power, and so they were afraid. And that in particular involves the tiny the minority, the Coptic minority, about 10%, and almost 50% of Egyptian women who were scared of the Iranian and the Taliban experience. And so they supported a return to authoritarian rule.
Why did all Arab Spring countries fail to achieve a push toward democracy?
There are a lot of reasons. One is that authoritarian rule had been very resilient for decades and centuries. The whole area had been ruled by autocratic rulers. And so the experience of democracy is limited, very rare. Secondly, the opposition had been very disunited. And so nobody was able to bring a democracy into the country. Thirdly, the transition from authoritarian rule to democracy faltered and led to a civil war in Libya, in Syria, in a way in Bahrain. And that also made the possibility of transition to democracy difficult. Economic challenges facing many of those countries. External interference. We had many governments intervening and supporting certain groups against others. The deep state in those countries that supported authoritarianism also played games. There was security concern that this transition is leading to the rise of terrorism and instability. The cultural factors, many also felt that democracy would bring the Islamists and the seculars are not ready to take over. And those who want democracy will not be elected. And those who are supporting autocracy are the one who will be elected. There was disillusionment with the initial outcome and what happened in Libya, in other countries. International support for stability. The EU, the Americans, and Israel, the Gulf state, wanted stability. They felt that democracy is going to be chaotic and it would lead to more insecurity for the whole region and the world. And so they supported reinstating authoritarian rule.
That was Said Sadiq, professor of political sociology at the Egypt-Japan University, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Pete Hundley, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.